The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 208.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He did an episode the other day with Macro Voices that really blew my mind and led to a whiteboard video, which I think is maybe one of my best. His name is Kevin Muir. Kevin, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Great to be with you today, George. I'm looking forward to chatting.
Yeah, dude, let's talk TGA.
Yeah, that's right, TGA. So for those who don't know, the TGA is the Treasury General Account, but I guess with your whiteboard, everyone will know about it now, right, George?
Well, I don't know about that. For those who watched, hopefully I was able to explain it. But can you give us kind of the Reader's Digest version of the TGA and then go into kind of the research you've done and what Janet Yellen is doing by dumping $1.1 trillion of bank reserves into the system?
For sure. So the TGA is basically, think about it as the government's checking account. And for the longest time, the government didn't need to do this because, you know, with the way that the system worked before the great financial crisis, there was no need for this. There was no need to go and there was no worries about bumping up against debt ceilings or anything like that. So the government never ran like a, you know, an actual balance. When they needed money, you know, when they spent money, they just went out into the bond market and borrowed it. Well, what happened was during the Obama era, they decided that, you know, maybe it made sense to go and pre-borrow some money in essence to get yourself ready for the debt ceiling kind of problems in case you needed to pay some bills and you couldn't actually borrow anymore because the Congress was stopping you from doing this. So they started this Treasury General Account, and it actually started growing. You know, the Obama administration, I think at one point it put it up to $400 billion. And the moving around of it ended up being probably more problematic than anyone understood. Because if you think about it, if the government goes and pre-borrows, what that means is they're taking money out of the system because they're actually going and issuing bonds and soaking up liquidity, but they're not putting it back into the actual real economy. So what happens is, at that point, you're pulling liquidity out, you're not putting anything in, and the economy, you know, sags. And then what happens is inevitably you pay it off, or you run it down, you spend it out, but it's just the opposite effect. You actually are just pushing money out into the system and you're not having to borrow. So it ends up being that this TGA, the moving of this account, surprised many economists and many market watchers in how much it was influencing the economy. And going into when Obama, stopped being the president and President Trump came in, we had this situation where in the early days, Mnuchin, who was the Treasury Secretary back then, ran it down from, I can't remember what the number is, like $400 billion down to $100 billion. And everyone talks about the stock market, you know, rally of Trump and how excited everyone was about Trump and all of his pro-growth policies. I've argued for a long time that it was actually more the function of the liquidity that was getting pushed out into the system with the running down of the TGA. And if you follow that throughout kind of Trump's presidency, you'll see points when he ran it up and the economy and the stock market sagged. And then when he ran it back down, meaning put it back down, brought it back down to, $100 billion or closer to zero, the economy took off. Well, then what happens is COVID occurs, and it's a disaster. Obviously, we all know the crisis, everything's going around in terms of they're just putting out fires wherever they can. And Mnuchin goes, and he takes this TGA account, and he runs it up to a point where previously the high had been $400 billion. He runs it up well over a trillion. And I've been writing about this for a long time that I had kind of thought, is Mnuchin a genius, like a Machiavellian figure that was running this up so that he could run it right back down right in front of the election to get us back off elected?
That's what I was thinking too.
Yeah. And I, for the longest time, thought, you know, this guy's really shrewd. He's run it up and he's going to run this thing right back down in the final moments of the election. The economy and the stock market's going to fly. Much to my surprise, he doesn't. He just leaves it. So we're sitting here now and it's $1 trillion to $6 trillion. And we have a situation where we have a new government and Yellen comes. And I didn't understand previously why Yellen was in such a hurry to get the TGA account down, because she's actually put in place guidance that shows that over the next, I guess it's 3 or 4 months, they're going to take this from $1.6 trillion down to like back to the $400 or even less in terms of it. So what that means is there's going to be $1.2 or $1.3 trillion, trillion with a T, of reserves getting pushed out into the system. Now, I had a listener or subscriber to my letter tell me that the reason is because they need to get that down so that they can go do the next round of kind of debt expansion and things like that. So it ends up being kind of forced upon them, because I think that if most people thought about this logically, they wouldn't go and unleash this torrent of reserves, bank reserves, into the system so quickly. It makes little sense, because it's going to have a problem in terms of the financial markets, how they deal with it. So let's talk about what's going to happen. The government is going to go spend, and what's going to happen is that they've already borrowed that money. So they're just going to spend freely, so that money is just going to go straight into the economy. Then what we're going to also have is the quantitative easing at the same time.
That's right.
So between these two things, we are going to have just a torrent of bank reserves sitting in the system.
Yeah, so Kevin, before, let me just stop you right there for a moment, just to make sure everyone's following us there. So guys, what happens when the TGA or the Treasury spends money? This is an account they have at the Federal Reserve. So it's not really in the commercial banking system. It's a liability of the Federal Reserve. So you can imagine these bank reserves are going into the TGA. That's their account balance, if you will. So when Janet Yellen writes someone a $100 stimmy check, let's say.
Yep. $1,200, isn't it? $1,600.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll say a $2,000 stimmy check. What ends up happening is that goes to the average Joe. The average Joe takes that check and deposits it at, let's say, Wells Fargo.
Right.
So now all of a sudden, that's an additional $2,000 liability for Wells Fargo, because the checking account is a liability of the commercial bank, just like the TGA is a liability of the Fed.
Right.
So then what ends up happening is the Fed comes in and says, okay, well, we've got to transfer the assets over to match up with that liability. So they take that $2,000 of bank reserves out of the TGA's account and move them into the commercial banking system, because they're going into Wells Fargo's account.
Yeah.
So why this is important is because now what you've done is you've increased M2 money supply. You've increased broad money in the real economy, chasing goods and services by $2,000. But you've also done $2,000 worth of basically quantitative easing, because now there's another $2,000 worth of bank reserves in the commercial banking system. Although the Fed's balance sheet hasn't changed, it's just moved from the TGA to Wells Fargo. There's an additional $2,000 worth of bank reserves that they can use to do whatever they want to do. So I think hopefully that gets people up to speed.
Right. And so one of the things, though, that I would like to stress is that a lot of people kind of put the two together, quantitative easing or the government spending money, and they say it's equally inflationary. And I do not believe that it is equally inflationary. I believe the quantitative easing is not as inflationary as everyone believes. And the reason for it is, if you think about, let's put aside the TGA for a second and just talk about quantitative easing. So the government goes out and buys bonds from, let's say JP Morgan. JP Morgan.
The Fed buys bonds.
Sorry. The Fed buys bonds from JP Morgan. You're absolutely right. Sorry. And JP Morgan sells them. You know, JP Morgan might have had them on their balance sheet, or they might have bought them for a client. But regardless, what happens is that they all of a sudden, JP Morgan is credited with cash, bank reserves, and the Federal Reserve is credited with the bonds. Now, everyone says, look at all this money supply going into the system. So therefore, that's got to create inflation. That's, you know, right. That's going to get lent out and then the multiplier effect. And it's going to be, you know, so on and so on. Next thing you know, fiat money's worthless and the end of the world. But let's just stop and think about JP Morgan. Do you think that they're going to change their behavior because they sold the Federal Reserve, you know, a couple of billion dollars of bonds? The reality is that JP Morgan is never reserve constrained when right. it comes to making loans. They are constrained by their balance sheet and they're constrained by the demand for loans.
Yeah. And so, the regulation, I think they've got some sort of liquidity leverage ratio.
In the old days, most banks were reserve constrained and there was a function of, you know, bumping up against this, but it's just not in the modern banking system. That's not right. the way it is. And so the reality is that quantitative easing, when it goes into the system and the Fed buys those bonds, it ends up being all these bank reserves on this commercial bank's balance sheets, and they're stuck with them. And if there was nothing else that happened, if the Federal Reserve didn't do anything else, what would happen is those reserves would be, you know, compete for interest, and they would be lent out at lower and lower rates, you know, at the government, and until rates went negative. And that's what's going to happen. Given that we can't have that in the Federal Reserve and governments don't want that, what the government does is they do something called interest on excess reserves. And so what that is it's basically an account at the Federal Reserve that commercial banks deposit those excess reserves in and they earn the interest.
Right.
And that way the Federal Reserve is able to maintain a minimum amount of interest. Now, let's get back to the TGA. So between the TGA and the quantitative easing, there's going to be a torrent of bank reserves in the system. And there's going to be so many that they're worried, the bond nerds, as I like to call them, like there's a whole bunch of these guys who really really into the plumbing and they're just geniuses. And they were the ones who kind of brought this up and brought it to my attention. There's so much liquidity going into the system. They're worried that the Federal Reserve is actually going to have to increase the interest on excess reserves to right. make sure that it doesn't go below zero.
Which is the Fed funds rate. I just want right. to clarify That's for people. Right. IOER.
Or T-bills or, you know, any of, you know, short-term money market interest instruments. Now, I've looked at this and I've kind of thought to myself, okay, so we have this huge amount of spending. And I believe the government spending is inflationary. So although I've just told you why quantitative easing isn't inflationary, I believe that fiscal spending is hugely inflationary. So when I look at this amount that Yellen is about to just kind of unleash into the system, it looked to me like just a huge torrent of liquidity. Right. And what I think's happened over the last couple of days is that the market finally woke up to this.
Mm.
And this is kind of a paradoxical kind of result of it. The market woke up to this huge amount of stimulus that was coming down the system, down the pipe. And they said, holy smokes, we're going to have inflation. And if we have inflation, the Fed's going to raise rates quicker than everyone thinks. So even though the Fed is busy telling us that they're on hold for the next 3 years, if you go look at, like, let's say a Fed funds future or a Eurodollar contract for a couple of years out, they went on, you know, Tuesday or Monday, they were pricing in maybe one rate rise because the curve is going to have a certain amount of, you know, steepness to it just because it has to. And to the point where they were pricing in two by kind of Thursday in the meat of the sell-off, two extra ones. So three total, but, you know, 2 years out. So what happened was we had this kind of pulling forward of rate hike expectations because of this TGA tsunami that everyone realized was going to come. And in doing so, it caused the bond market to freak out. And it's actually, you know, created a whole bunch of distortions. Interestingly enough, I actually think that, you know, given this change, for the first time, I look at the short end of the curve and I go, you probably can own it. Because now all of a sudden, whereas before I was worried there was no hikes priced in, now all of a sudden there's a few hikes. Like, I look at the Fed and I take them at their word. I think they're going to actually hang in there and not raise rates for the next couple of years. And if they follow through, then all of a sudden you have, 75 basis points of pickup. So that's what happened over the last couple of days. Because if you kind of took it at its face and said, there's this TGA of liquidity coming, shouldn't that be inflationary? Shouldn't we see the yield curve steepening? And in fact, we saw the opposite. We saw the yield curve flattening. We saw inflation break evens falling. And the reason is because the bond market kind of got nervous about that and got said the Fed is going to panic. And they started pricing in a Fed that's panicking quicker than the Fed that's what they're trying to tell us.
Right. Okay. So what's, and I just want to back up just a little bit to make sure everyone's following us there. So okay. When there's a ton of bank reserves in the commercial banking system, there's, let's say they don't know what to do with them. And also you match that up with the fact that now they have these additional liabilities. And even though most people would say, well, I don't know, I'm not getting paid any money on my checking account.
Right.
It's very true. But the bottom line, they have a bit of a cost associated with an extra, let's say, $1 trillion.
Right.
Of broad money in the commercial banking system, those liabilities. So they've got another $1 trillion in bank reserves. Okay, that's great. But they want to get some sort of return that's higher than the couple basis points they're getting at the Fed, even though that's, IOERs might be, was it zero and between zero and 25 basis points? That's their spread right now.
Right.
So they want a little bit more. So they want some sort of asset instead of those bank reserves that can give them a higher return. So they look for what they call pristine collateral.
Right.
And I would refer back to, I don't know if I'd call him a bond nerd, but maybe Jeff Snyder would accept that title.
I think he would. I think Jeff would like it. I think he'd be honored to be called a bond nerd.
So Snyder would say, okay, they need some pristine collateral so they can, go into the repo market. They can rehypothecate those T-bills. They can make a bit of a return on there. Yeah. So this increases demand for those T-bills. If there's increased demand, the price goes up. If the price goes up, the interest rate goes down. And that's what takes us into this weird situation where you could actually have the short end of the curve go negative while the long end of the curve is actually, I think, what did the 10-year get up to 1.6 Friday?
Yeah, it was a long way.
And
it's kind of amazing to think about the fact that in a situation where we're running these monster deficits, there's a shortage of collateral.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, so let me just, and for those of the people that don't speak macro, that means, so there we have all of this, all these new bank reserves being created, and the government is spending money, let's say like a drunken sailor. Was it $5 trillion deficit that we had in 2020 or something like that? Right. And all this stimulus money and just unbelievable deficit spending. So they're creating all of these new treasuries.
Right.
Treasury, all these new treasuries, but yet it's not enough to satisfy the demand of the market. Why? Because the Fed has created so many bank reserves through the process of quantitative easing over the past, however many years. So now it puts us into this weird position. So, I mean, if you're the I was talking to an individual last night on my member live stream. The person really knew their stuff. And they said, okay, do you think that they can get out of this bind by potentially doing some sort of like operation twist where maybe the Fed has T-bills, so they sell T-bills while they buy the long end of the curve, or these, if they've got treasuries that are maturing, they just roll the long end of the curve, the 10-year and 30 years that are maturing, they roll those over into T-bills, and maybe that kind of acts
for sure.
As maybe a buffer to give us a little more supply for that demand that Janet Yellen is going to be creating.
Right. So I completely agree that they're looking at all these things. They're looking at the plumbing. They're trying to figure it out. But I think that, unless you're trading, a short-term interest rate trader, what they do is probably not as important as the fact that we have this tsunami of liquidity coming down. So let's step back and, you know, let's not get too hung up about that. Cause like, unless you're trading swap spreads or, you know, worried about, you know, IOER, you know, OIS kind of, you know, spreads against stuff, who cares? The one thing to think about is that we are getting this tsunami of liquidity that's coming down. And I do believe that, although I don't think quantitative easing causes inflation, I do believe that spending, government spending, causes inflation, or at least influences inflation. And I think that they both cause risk assets to be bid. And that is the one thing as an investor, I think you should step back and say, you know, typically March is a seasonal weak point. Usually you get a sell off on around tax the time because of the liquidity. People are writing checks for their liquidity. And here we are, we're going to have a March that's almost the exact opposite. We're going to have a March that the liquidity is bearing down on us in full force. And I look at this and I say we should be aware of this, and I kind of come up with a few things that, you know, trades out of that you should be thinking about. One thing is, don't underestimate the fact that even though the stock market has gone a long way, it could get a lot stupider. It could keep going. Like, there's this liquidity needs to find a home somewhere. The old TINA, there is no alternative. And especially if you have a situation where the short end, there's nowhere to put it because of the fact that there's a shortage of collateral, you could see people and investors going out the risk curve. And then the other thing to think about is, if you're creating all these dollars in this huge rush, it's increasing the supply of dollars. That in itself is also, you know, kind of inflationary, and it causes the U.S. dollar to go down. And at the same time, it probably means that things like the commodity trade and all these other trades are probably going to continue based upon this, you know, monster tsunami of liquidity. I think that people, you know, we've gotten kind of numb to these amounts, right?
Like, we
go kind of like, oh, geez, you know, it's a billion, you know, what's a billion, a trillion? Like, it just kind of sounds different, you know, doesn't sound that different. But when you actually go look at these numbers, and like, this is one of the things that when I was digging into this, I was like, this is just an absolute crazy amount of liquidity that's coming down. Like, it was just shocking to me. And, you know, it kind of feels like the quantitative easing in the COVID crisis. I remember when the COVID crisis hit, and I used to go and I would be getting the sheet from the Fed and the amounts of kind of securities they were buying every day, because you can actually sign up and get it. And I was looking through these things, and it would just be like 500 million of this issue, 700 million of this issue. And I'd be like, these are just monster numbers. And I think that we've kind of lost track of how big this is. And so when I'm thinking about this and thinking about the risks and what you should be thinking about as an investor, I think you should be really kind of aware that this has the potential of starting off an inflationary boom, the likes that we haven't seen before.
And maybe even in assets. Let me make it real simple for the listener here. And correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, but the research that I did showed the Fed is currently doing $120 billion per month in QE.
Right. It was something around that. Yeah.
Forgot about. You know,
yeah, exactly. Infinity.
And so if Yellen comes out and does, let's say, $1 trillion over the next 4 months, that's an additional $250 billion of QE on top of the existing 120. So we're at $370 billion dollars per month in QE. To give some context, QE3, which was just an unfathomable amount in financial history, was $85 billion.
And we're going to do 300. And then to top it all off, it's not just QE, it's actual spending. And the problem with QE is that you put it, it just goes into the banking system. Whereas when you spend it and you put it in people's hands, and especially people that need it, especially people that are, you know, having trouble in this difficult area time, they're spending it and putting it into the real economy, which is dramatically different than what we've experienced before. And that's one of the things that I like. If we step back, and one of the things that I truly believe is that there's still a lot of folks out there that are deflationists. They believe that this trend towards lower and lower interest rates has not gone away. This is just a cyclical upturn, just like we had in 08 and just like we had in 2000, but each peak is going to be less and less. And there's some very famous people that have been kind of in this camp. And I've always said that we always, you know, they believe that deflation is inevitable. And I always said that if we have the political will, we can always offset deflation. And I always kind of laugh and say, you know, I know lots of countries that have collapsed because of inflation. I know none that have collapsed because of deflation. And so when people tell me that we're going to, you know, that this deflation is going to happen and there's no way we can offset it, I always said to them, no, you don't understand. The government can go and print this money into existence or spend this money into existence is a better way of putting it. Right. And like one of the things that I believe is that we've spent the last 40 years using the monetary, you know, monetary levers to try to influence the economy. You know, after 81, we saw Volcker came in there, broke the back of inflation. And ever since then, every time we've had an economic crisis, an economic slowdown, we've solved it by going and lowering interest rates. Mm-hmm. And interest rates, when you lower them, you encourage private sector to borrow, whether it be the house or whether it be households or whether it be corporations. You make it cheaper for them to borrow. So eventually they go and they start borrowing, and money is created through the banking system. Bank makes a loan, that money is being created. And we've relied on that for, you know, four decades until the great financial crisis came. Great financial crisis comes, we all of a sudden hit the zero bound. We try to get people to borrow money and no one will borrow money. And we're hit this point. And it's kind of like, this was kind of the realization that monetary policy had reached its, you know, final point where they couldn't work anymore. Then they go, they try to convince us that quantitative easing is going to cause all this inflation and that they're going to be able to do all these same things. But the truth of the matter is the monetary policy has become completely impotent at these levels. And I would argue that it's actually become worse than impotent. If you go look at like a country like Europe or a region like Europe, they're going and they're trying to use monetary policy and they're putting rates more and more negative to try to encourage people to borrow. Ironically, if you think about if you're, you know, let's say an Italian saver and you have to put your kid through school and the government makes it so that instead of earning, you know, 1% on your bond, you're actually earning minus 1%. What do? Well, you still have this obligation to put your kid through school. So, you know, what kind of strangely happens is you end up saving more, not less, right. Because you still, you know, you still have the same obligation. And now all of a sudden the government's taking away your savings. So we hit this point where monetary policy became completely impotent. It no longer worked. And to me, it was just a matter of time before countries realize that there was a second way to create money, and that is for the government to spend it into existence. And then COVID came along, and if you remember back in March, everyone was saying, or not everyone, but most people were saying, there's no way the economy is going to bounce. There's no way this is going to work. This is the end of the world. And people were very bearish. And what did the government do? They went and spent. And everyone was kind of shocked at how much of the demand you could see get replaced by government spending. The government could spend the money into existence. Now, you might say, this is going to end badly. Eventually, the government's going to spend too much. Completely agree. I think that is absolutely what's going to happen. The governments are going to realize that, you know, that what seems great at the beginning, they will overdo. And they will spend too much and we will create inflation. But I kind of look at it and go, you know, governments, you know, we abuse monetarism. Why are we not going to abuse fiscalism? You know, why is one necessarily better than the other? Monetarism, you know, when I look at this negative rates in Europe, I say this is just a complete aberration of how the system should work. So don't give me this that, you know, we shouldn't go down this other road. And then more importantly is, you know, regardless, George, of what you and I think should be done, like we can sit here and debate about what's the proper thing to do. And we could talk about the optimum, you know, economic settings and stuff. And we could talk about the morality of inflation or not. It doesn't matter. We like what we believe doesn't mean two craps, right? Like what we should be concerned about is where are we headed? What is going to happen? And when I look at it, it just looks to me like we're going to spend more and more. And even though all these people tell me that we're not going to be able to create inflation, I look at it, I see a Federal Reserve that is willing to do average inflation targeting. So whereas in the past, every time inflation went, 2%, they cranked rates up and stopped it. So, 2% used to be a ceiling. It almost feels like it's the opposite now with this new average inflation targeting. It almost feels like it's going to be a floor. I see a government that's willing to spend like there's no tomorrow. And I look at this and I go, there's a lot of risk that we actually create a ton of inflation on the other side. And in some ways, it's going to be good because let's face it, we have too much debt. And if you run inflation at 5% for a decade, a lot of that debt gets, worked away.
As long as the tax receipts go up with inflation. that's a whole other rabbit hole. Because I've done some videos where I've kind of thought through how we could have like 1970s consumer price inflation while at the same time the receipts, the tax revenues going to the government actually go down. But that's a whole different...
It's difficult. But the other thing that I think that people forget and they kind of think about this debt and let's take Japan, for example. I'm always told that there's all this debt on Japan's balance sheet and they're never going to be able to escape it. And if you look, Japan has 250% of their debt, to GDP outstanding, right?
Right.
But the thing is, the Bank of Japan owns half of it.
Right.
So what is the real debt to GDP? If the Bank of Japan, one night just said, let's just cut this, flatten this out, it would be gone.
Yeah.
And then you might say, well, geez, if you can do that, that means that the government is, there's no constraints. And I kind of go, well, yeah, there never was a constraint because the government is a currency issuer, not a currency user. And there was never a constraint. The only real constraint is like a real resource constraint. Eventually you spend too much and you compete against real assets and you can only produce so much. But when you're thinking about how to design your portfolio, whereas the past we could never bump up against that constraint, I think we are going to bump up against that constraint. And I think it means a lot in terms of how you set up things going forward.
Yeah. Boy, there's a lot that we could discuss right there for sure. I gave that a lot of thought because I listened to Grant Williams and Bill Fleckenstein talk about that. And I think Bill's been kind of racking his brain on how to, what would happen if Japan did a debt jubilee. And I gave it a lot of thought, not that I'm at that level at all, but I gave it a lot of thought. I thought, and I came to the conclusion that probably nothing, it wouldn't really do anything. But my thought process was the damage has already been done. Once the government spends enough money to get up to 250% debt to GDP, they've already created the economic distortions, the misallocation of resources, the malinvestment by spending the money in the first place.
Yeah,
so what I did is I compared it to a heroin addict. So if you got a heroin addict that has a credit card and they become a heroin junkie by running up $100,000, let's say on their credit card, right, what happens if you give them a debt jubilee? Well, great. Now they can go out and buy another $100,000 of heroin, but the damage has already been done.
Yeah, but I don't know if I would call it damage. Like in some ways, I look at let's just take the great financial crisis. When we had this situation where the private sector didn't want to employ people, it was, it was contracting in credit. And what did the government do? The government went out or the Federal Reserve went out and bought bonds. And tell me how buying bonds was the right call at this time when in essence, nobody was willing to spend. And that is the time the government could have gone, borrowed, instead of buying bonds, they should have been issuing bonds at 1% and putting fiber to everyone's home. They should be doing countercyclical, decisions. And so I'm not as kind of negative about government spending. There's no doubt there's tons of government waste. But at the same time, I think that we've been obsessed with trying to cut government spending. And all that ends up happening is that we try to, because the economy suffers from that, all that ends up happening is that we have to lower rates more and more to try to, convince the private sector to create money. So, I look at Europe, for example. Europe to me, instead of trying to get their private sector to borrow money by putting rates even more negative, which doesn't work, I look at them and go, why don't you start, like, you know, actually spending some money, put it into the system, create it. And the other thing that I look at, George, is that the government's debit is the private sector's credit. There's always another side to every equation. And so you look at
but not the Fed's monetizing it.
No, but I think the Fed monetizing it is a different part of it.
If the Fed's creating bank reserves to buy that debt, that's not an asset in the private sector's balance sheet.
No. If you go through like a something and realize that like it just changes the composition of the reserves, but it's still an asset to the private sector. I believe that when the Federal Reserve, when they do their quantitative easing, they're just changing the composition of it. They're not changing the actual debit or credit. And I think that's the part that a lot of people get stuck on. And you know, we could go a long way on this. And I just think that kind of a better discussion is to realize that there's no doubt that in the past, these deficit hawks and the austerity kind of, you know, that kind of thinking, it dominated, right? Like let's stop and think about what happened when Greece went into their, you know, issue. They went and the EU told them to cut spending. They cut it, cut. And one of the things that you should realize is that the COVID was the first time that we've had kind of a crisis like this. And everyone's spent, and it's different. And so regardless if you think it's right or wrong, I think you should realize that it's happened. And the real question to me, like I think if there was one, if you said to me, Kev, you can have one question answered, you know, what would it be? Like, you know, you can look forward and we'll give you the answer to one question. My question would be, on the other side of the COVID, when the economy gets going, what will the public's or even the government's attitude towards debt and deficit spending be? Because if we get a return to, we have to balance books, we have to, you know, we're leaving this for our grandchildren, then I think that what you're going to find is that our economy looks like Europe's. It'll very quickly fall in on itself and we'll have the same problems. But if you find the opposite, where the government says, no, we're going to continue to spend on infrastructure, we're going to do it more like the kind of the Chinese and, you know, say what you want about them, but they've managed growth in their economy and they've done it. I think that if you find that they do that, then it will change your investment strategy completely.
Yeah, see, I think maybe they spend it on infrastructure. I think it's a lot more likely they just keep sending people checks in the mail.
Well, see, now that's terrible. Like, that doesn't work. Like, I know it needs to be done now, but that's a problem. And the reason that's a problem is, in essence, you know, we talked about that there is no financial constraint, but there's a real resource constraint. If you're not doing productive things, if you're not creating goods and services, if you're not making your society and your economy more productive, then you bump up against that inflation constraint way earlier.
And then let's talk about the constraint when you're reducing supply, because you're locking people in their houses, you're shutting down businesses. You've got 300,000 small and mid-sized businesses in the United States. That creates that constraint that you're talking about is actually shrinking as a result of the government while they're increasing aggregate demand.
You're absolutely right. Like, I look at, like, I think it's funny that people will tell me that, you know, we're not going to have a boom when the economy opens back up. I go, listen, you have people with all this money in their pockets and you have less supply. You have the perfect ingredients for an inflationary spike.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
You know, we go back to 1981 when Volcker jacked rates, up to 18%, something like that, Fed funds to try to crush inflation. And I always just assumed that, okay, that was Volcker. He broke the back of inflation. I just kind of, for whatever reason in my mind, assumed that we kept interest rates relatively low throughout the 1970s. Just because you didn't have someone like Volcker that was willing to increase them sky high to try to do it. But I actually did a video the other day when I looked at the Fed funds rate throughout the 1970s.
Right.
And they actually did. I don't know if they were trying to, but in the early 70s, they bumped rates up to like 11 or 12%. And then they brought them back down, I think maybe in like 74, 75, something like that. And then in like 79, they brought them way up to, you know, 16, 17%. Then they brought them back down. And then it was like the third time that when Volcker came in and did it, that they actually were able to defeat inflation. But my point with that is that we just think that all we have to do to get the inflation genie back in the bottle is just raise interest rates really quick one time and we're done. No problem, Kevin. Why should we even worry about this? But what people don't understand, we live in the 1970s, sometimes it takes two, three, maybe four times of doing this for the next decade to actually get the inflation genie back in the bottle.
So I would push back against that a little bit. I would argue that what was happening and what a lot of people failed to realize is the fact that there's the fiscal component. And part of the reason that we were having high rates, yet we were still having inflation, was we were spending. Don't forget that in the late 60s, early 70s, we had the Vietnam War.
Right.
And we had the New Deal. And there was a lot of spending going on. There's a famous economist / hedge fund manager. They call him the father of MMT, and his name is Warren Mosler. And Warren Mosler argues that the people that think that monetary policy are driving, you know, the actual economics is like when you have your kid in the back car, a seat of the car, and you give them a steering wheel and they think they're driving, but the reality is that the person up front is driving. And his argument is that fiscal policy has always played a much bigger role than we ever imagined.
Oh, yeah.
I happen to disagree with him. I think you need to put the two together. I don't think that there's one can, you know, explain everything. And one of the things that I have my biggest pushback to MMT is that they focus solely on the government spending or the fiscal side of things. And they almost forget about the monetary side.
Yeah,
so
right.
To me, it feels like we've gone from focusing solely on creating money through, you know, on the monetary side through private sector credit creation to now only talking about the government side. And the reality is that they're both going and trying to figure out which force is more dominant at any particular time is important. And, you know, Lynn Alden, I know she's on your show often and she's just genius. She's the one that, I don't know if she got this from somewhere, but, you know, she talks about monetary dominance versus fiscal dominance. And you'll get periods where the fiscal side will count for more, and you'll get periods where the monetary side will count for more.
Right.
And I definitely work. Lynn and I are both on the same page that we've transitioned from monetary to fiscal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when you say that people think you can raise rates and cut the back of inflation or stop inflation, I would argue the reason you could raise rates and cut the back of inflation was because, don't forget, we were running, not austerity, but we weren't running big deficits, especially when you compare them to now.
Yeah, right.
And well, so
do that now. I mean, there's no way when you look at the amount of debt in the system, I mean, that would completely crush the entire economy when you got balance sheets of the consumer, the government, the corporations at all-time highs with leverage. My goodness, that would. And even Volcker said that before he passed away.
Oh, did he? I didn't realize that. He said
that. Yeah, I think someone asked him that if we got inflation, could we raise interest rates like you did back in 1981? And he said, absolutely not. There's no way. There's just way too much debt in the system to do that again.
And so I guess one of the things is, though, if you're using a fiscal lever that to control inflation, really what happens when inflation comes from now on, you should be increasing taxes or spending less.
Yeah, but see, the pushback I always have there is if you look at the tax receipts as a percentage of GDP going back to, let's say, the 1940s, regardless of the highest marginal rate, you're right about 18%. So, I mean, even if you said, okay, we need to increase taxes on the, let's say, if you make over $100,000 up to 70% because we've got this inflation, we got to get liquidity out of the system. And we need fewer currency units. Therefore, we need that going into the TGA. So it's not in the system. But people just won't pay it. I mean, and what if they don't pay it? The liquidity doesn't come out of the system. And it's going to be very tough to. Now, in a textbook, it works perfect with a calculator.
Yeah. No doubt. Like it's difficult to turn spending on and off is the other thing, right? Like you don't go do an infrastructure program. And then the moment inflation pops up, you go, oh, wait, we're going to stop making that subway. Like there's no doubt there's all sorts of problems with it. I don't have any answers, and I don't even think it matters. Like most people, you know, they love arguing about what should be done. I'm like, I don't care what should be done. All I care about is what will be done. And so I look at it and I go, I see this. Everyone talks about the baby boomers being this generation that, you know, they do own the most assets and they are a huge influence on terms of fiscal side. But when you look at the actual numbers, the millennials, there's more millennials out there right now.
Yeah, right.
Like they're the largest cohort. I think one of these days they're going to start voting. And I know they vote, but like, I mean, they're going to start doing it. And, you know, like one of my big themes of the last year has been own housing and like U.S. housing. And I've argued for a while that the millennials, although they tell us that they're different and then they're not going to go make households and they're not going to have kids and stuff, I call BS on that. They're just a little later. That's all it is. And I think it's been a great trade to see, you know, like if you look at housing over the last year, it's been terrific. So I think that what you're going to find, though, is that the as the millennials vote, they're going to do more things like, you know, they didn't pass the minimum wage increase. This like it doesn't look like it made it through this deal. But, you know, let's see in 4 years the new next round of people. Like we still have a bunch of 80-year-olds running the government, right? We have Pelosi, Schumer, Biden. There's all these, you know, all these old people, right? And I kind of laugh. I'm a Gen X. I feel like they're just gonna miss our whole generation. And that's typical Gen X. We just don't like they're just gonna miss us, right? Like I'm gonna laugh so hard if we never have a president. They go right from baby boomer to millennial.
Because that's what the AOC.
it feels like that a little bit. And if that happens, then you can sit there and you can talk about how this is all going to end bad and that this is terrible for our economy, but it's not going to help your portfolio one bit. Right. And that's one of the things that I just like to stress to people is that be careful about worrying too much about what should be done. You know, you're welcome to talk about that while you're, you know, chatting with your friends. But when you're thinking about what will be done, you know, put aside your feelings about what you think should be done and just, you know, look at what's going to actually happen in the economy.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I want to touch on that in a moment when we conclude, Kevin. But prior to getting there, I want to go back to the TGA just a moment, to sort through kind of some like a thought experiment. And I was trying to think, okay, you've got the yield curve. If the short end goes negative and the long end of the curve, you get this steepener effect that you were talking about on Macro Voices. I'm assuming that there's a lot of hedge funds, sovereign wealth funds, financial institutions that would run into a world of hurt if the T-bills were trading negative. Or I assume the Fed would not want T-bills.
I don't think though the Fed doesn't want that for a world of hurt from the hedge funds. I think that the Fed doesn't want that because it messes up money markets because they can't, you know, there's all sorts of like plumbing issues with just the day-to-day things that they don't want negative T-bills. And I know we've had negative T-bills for short periods, but to have them on a sustained basis would not be good. And I don't think any of our systems are really designed for it.
Okay.
Like, you know, and I think it has more to do with that. Like, just even think about money market funds. Like, don't you buy it at a dollar and just earn interest? Well, what happens now all of a sudden? How do you buy it? And, you know, how do they charge you? Like, you buy it at a dollar and then you have to give them another, you know.
Yeah, what does the average Joe do with that? Exactly.
So I think that I actually think that that side of it is not really a market concern so much as it's a plumbing concern in terms of some kind of short end things. And I'm not that concerned about that side of it. If anything, you know, if the Fed was thinking about it kind of thoughtfully, I think they would be more concerned about the dollar or something, or you know, like another, or even a melt up in the stock market. You know, like at the end of the day, I don't think that I don't think they're prepared to go raise rates or talk.
Okay, so that was basically my question. Do you think that they get to a point where they're like, okay, we can't have these negative rates on the short end, therefore, even though we don't want to, we've got to raise the Fed funds rate up to, you know, 50 basis points, 1% or whatever, to try to bring up that low end of the curve?
So, no, I don't think that they would do Fed funds, but I think that they're going to go do a technical adjustment on the IOER, the interest on excess reserves. And that's something I wrote about. I said that chances are they're going to increase that while leaving their Fed funds target unchanged. So you might see that go up by 5 or 10 basis points, just enough to pull, you know, to help in terms of bringing it up. And one of my concerns was that if you weren't aware of that and you weren't thinking about it and you just saw on the next, March FOMC meeting, you saw Fed raised rates, you might like, you know, go, holy smokes, I'm going to sell everything, sell my stocks. And you might view it as the Fed being hawkish. Whereas in reality, the reason they're raising the IOER is because there's so much liquidity. So it'd be, they would be forced to almost do this raise just to keep this, the base, you know, keep it from slipping below zero. And even though you might think, oh, that's bad, they're taking liquidity out of the system, the reality is that the reason they're taking out liquidity out of the system is because there's been so much added in another way.
Right. So what do you think that does to the long end, if anything?
So I don't think
they raise IOER.
I don't think it does anything. I think the long end is going to trade on inflation expectations. And I think that the long end will start to, you know, I think the long end is looking at it and trying to decide if the Fed is serious about leaving rates unchanged for as long as they are. So if you think about a long bond investor, what is their worst nightmare? Like, let's just assume, let's take default off the table, right? Like, because let's face it, U.S. isn't going to default on their debt. So let's take that off the table. The long bond investor's worst nightmare is inflation. So even though everyone thinks that the Fed raising rates, that must cause bonds to go down, the reality is, like, if the Fed turned around tomorrow and raised rates to 100 basis points, you know, maybe the long bond would go down for a little bit, but before you know it, the long bond would be screaming because what would happen is the economy would implode, and therefore you would find that people would be like, I got to own a safe asset. I want to own the longest duration asset. I'm going to buy bonds. So if we think about what the Fed's been telling you over the, you know, for the last 9 months, ever since COVID, they've been telling you we want to let the economy run hot. We're willing to allow inflation to run hotter than it previously has. Right. We want the 2%, whereas when we used to get upset about 2%, we're going to let it run 3-4 before we get upset. So if you're thinking about it from a long bond investor's kind of, you know, perspective, what that means is that you're going to get your asset inflated away. So you don't want to own, like, in that environment, you don't want to own long bonds.
Right.
So when you go back and you ask, how is the TGA going to affect it? I think that all of these things are telling the market that the Fed and the government are doing more and more to create inflation. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it behooves you to be less long, you know, long bonds, like long duration bonds.
At what point do you think they have to peg the long end?
So I a lot of people, you know, if you remember back, like, you know what, the 10-year went to 50 basis points in the COVID crisis. And then on the way back up, I would turn on the Twitter or turn on, you know, read my research and all these people talking about, we have to peg it at one, we have to peg it at 110, we have to peg it at 120. And right. I'm just hearing all these guys, and I kind of think to me myself, it's all the bond bulls that want you to peg it. Like, it's, they're the ones. I don't view a steep yield curve as something the Fed is against. I think that it's actually, as long as it's steepening because of future inflation or future growth, I think it's fine. And I think the government will be fine with it. One of the things that I do think
is different than growth, right?
Well, like, I think
you can have higher prices, but it doesn't,
I don't think they really care, to be truthful. They just need, they need nominal growth. And whether that's, you know, 2% real and 3% inflation or 4% inflation and 1% real, I don't think they care that much. Like, I think what they don't want is, you know, like, there to be a problem. Like, bonds went down in during the COVID crisis because of actual problems in the market. Like, that was a different time. Like, you actually saw there wasn't enough money in the system and bonds were actually not bid. Right. And there was, that was like an actual market dislocation. And it wasn't that they thought that the Fed was, you know, that we were going to have inflation, that like the system stopped working. Right. But if you have a situation where the long bond is going down in yield, and as long as it doesn't do it too quickly, I think that they're going to be fine with it. And if you think about it, if they want health in the system, there's nothing better than having, you know, like a steeper yield curve. It helps banks. It helps a lot of parts of the economy. And I look at it and I say, I don't think the Fed's going to do it. Like, I just don't buy it. And everyone says, well, they can't afford to have it go up. And I go, well, they're just going to flow more at the short end. And we're just going to do it. And like, it might not be the right decision. But again, stop worrying about the right decisions. Just start thinking about what they're going to do. When you listen to them, they're telling you they're not going to do it.
Like, I just wonder about like mortgage rates. You know, if you get the 10-year going up to, say, 3%, 4%, something like that, then you think through mortgage rates and then the housing market and how dependent the economy is on home equity. That's kind of what I think.
Yeah, I guess it'll depend on how the economy is doing. And maybe they'll figure out ways to boost, like to tighten spreads against mortgages. Like, maybe they'll go and, you know, boost that.
Mortgage-backed securities.
Yeah, or like, you know, you change the tax. You know, there's a million ways to do things. I just don't know why we're in such a rush to peg the yield curve. Like, I always tell people, I go, pull up a 40-year chart of 30 years, you know, or 10-year bonds, and then tell me why you think that this move from 50 to 1.25 or wherever we are is now all of a sudden we have to peg the yield curve. Like, you realize that in 2018, which was just 2 years ago, the long bond was 3.25. The economy, right, you know, wasn't great, but it wasn't the end of the world. Like, we were still managing. And so to me, I don't buy this peg the yield curve. I think anybody that is talking about pegging the yield curve is too focused on monetary means of stimulating the economy. And so if I'm correct that it's going to be more the government spending money into existence, we get more, you know, actual government infrastructure spending and stuff like that, the long end will move around and it won't matter as much as everyone thinks it matters. People are just thinking to themselves, they're fixated on this idea, the only way to get the economy going is through private sector credit creation. And they're ignoring the possibility that the government could actually do it. And now, you might hate that. You might think it's terrible. Fine, so be it. But if the government does it, it's still going to mean that the long end could go to 4 or 5%. Like, I've said for the longest time that I think before this cycle is through, the yield curve, meaning the difference between the short end and the long end, will go to record wides.
Yeah.
Like, I could see a situation where, like, the long end, the short end is 1% and the long end is 6, 7. Like, you know, I could see that happening, you know, before this is all through.
What do you think about what Russell Napier said with Eric. Did you? I don't know if you heard that. If you didn't,
I didn't. I missed it. I'm huge. I got to go listen to it because I'm a huge Russell Napier fan. I have this joke with Patrick that I said if Patrick's my partner and you know on the Market Huddle, and I always say if I can go drinking with one of our guests, it's always Russell Napier that's my pick. Like that's the guy whose brain I want to pick. I think he's this. I think he's witty. He's, you know, he's got that. Is he Scottish or Irish? I can't remember. I think he's Irish, but he lives in Scotland. Anyways, he's just funny. But I think his thinking is brilliant. So whatever he said, I'm probably gonna be like, you know, he's way ahead of me.
Yeah, well, he just had this hypothesis that the government would come in and do a ton of fiscal. Exactly what you're saying. And if inflation got out of hand, or the way they'd control it is they'd start controlling commercial bank credit. So because he's thinking if we have this fiscal on top of, let's just say the banking system continues to create credit at the same rate while we get this fiscal, then you get inflation, where he said the government might come and continue the fiscal so they can aim it and direct it wherever they want it to go. But then they restrict the commercial banking system.
Oh, I see.
Their lending.
To use regulatory means to control monetary expansion on the private sector side. Listen, I completely agree. Who knows? Maybe they do that. Like that is a way to do it. But he, you know, at least he understands the two sides of the puzzle. Meaning that he's not just solely focused on the public side, and he's not solely focused on the private side. He understands that there's both, and that it's really how they, you know, the combination of the two is going to decide how much inflation there is. And his argument is that, you know, that if the government is going to be so keen to do their side, that if they do run into inflation, they're going to try to, you know, limit it by the commercial. Yeah. It could be. Like I won't disagree. I don't know how it's going to play out, but I do agree with his analysis about how the economy works.
Okay, cool. So I know I've kept you over an hour, Kevin. Let's go through for the viewer and the listener kind of what your ideas are from a standpoint of portfolio construction. We talked about kind of these theoretical things, but let's get down into the nitty-gritty. On what people can actually do to prepare if we go into this inflationary environment where we get the steepening, the long end is going up, they're not pegging the curve, but we get tons and tons of fiscal. So, I mean, we just pretty much go down the line. We could talk about, you know, your opinion on housing. We touched on that briefly. Bitcoin, gold, commodities, you know, stocks, bonds.
Okay. I'm a famous no coiner. So the Bitcoin, I'm not a big fan. I'm actually even worse than a no coiner, George. I actually, I had a kid that was working beside me. I can't remember when it was. And he told me about this thing called Bitcoin. And he explained it all to me. And he said, you know, I said, how much does it cost? He says, it's like $5. And I said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Don't ever bring that up again. And then, you know, it comes out, you know, a month later, 2 months later, he says, you know, that thing you told me was the stupidest thing you ever heard? It's $50. And to my credit, I said, well, if it's 50, it could be 500, it could be 5,000, although I never guessed it'd be 50,000. And I said, you know, I can't bring myself to buy this thing, but, you know, the bits in the sky, but, you know, tell me about mining. So we actually became miners like way back when, like literally we were mining at like $100. Like we were buying these butterfly machines from China. It made our office so hot. We had to put it in our garage up here in Canada. It was hilarious. And we actually created like this arbitrage between exchanges. And so everyone assumes that I'm a no coiner and that I don't know what I'm talking about. And it's like, no, I'm a no coiner. That's just an idiot. But I just can't bring myself to buy bits in the sky. So we'll just skip that one. Maybe it's just my stupidity for not buying. I'll never forgive myself.
We talked about housing. And one thing that I've been saying on my channel is because prices are so high in the United States, and it doesn't mean they're not going higher, I've almost kind of changed my thinking to see the property as the liability on your balance sheet. But if you can secure that property, especially if it's a rental producing positive cash flow with 30-year fixed rate debt, the debt is almost the asset.
I completely agree with you.
The liability.
So if you think Yeah. So if you think about it, if my scenario comes to play and we do get inflation, then you want to be, you know, like the past 40 years has been, you know, creditors have won over debtors. You've wanted to own bonds, right? Like that's you, the person with the asset has done well. I think that in the other way, you know, if we get a situation where we get inflation, then it'll be debtors will win over creditors.
Right.
And therefore, you want to be issuing as much debt and buying whatever assets that you can. And I agree that, it, you know, property is one way to look at. I personally think that one of the things about, you know, everyone thinks that housing has gone so up much in the States. I think that a lot of the housing that's gone up has actually been the one percenter. Like it's the gateway cities. It's the coasts. It's the LA's, San Francisco's, New York's, Miami's, right? Like all those housing has exploded. But if I think when you go to the heartland and you go to like, you know, Atlanta and stuff, I don't think there's been quite the rise in rate. I mean, in property values. And so to me, I look at it and I think to myself, if I was somebody that was looking at this from a long-term basis, I would be buying kind of middle of America housing. And I would, as you say, I would borrow as long as I could and lock it in. Yeah, and so.
Okay, cool. So how about gold and commodities?
So commodities and gold, gold has suffered over the last little while because of the backup in bonds.
Yeah, it seems like everyone's forgot about gold.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is that I do believe the bits in the sky has really attracted a lot of attention.
Yeah,
all you have to do is look at, you know, like somebody like Raoul Paul, you know, the founder of Real Vision. I thought he was insane. Like it was, what, 4 months ago? He said, I'm selling all my gold and I'm buying, you know, Bitcoin. And I, you know, hats off to him. It was a ballsy call. Like it was to get out there and say this and to do it, I'm a trader. I appreciate a great trade. It was a terrific trade. But when you think about it, there has to be a lot of people like him that would have previously owned gold that now own the bits in the sky. So I think that gold has suffered from the popularity of Bitcoin.
Okay.
And all you have to do, I think I did on one of my pieces I wrote about, if you look at the correlation between Bitcoin and gold, it had previously been positive and almost approaching one. And it has now become completely uncorrelated and might even be on its way to being negatively correlated, meaning that as Bitcoin goes up, gold goes down.
Right.
So I think gold suffered from the bits in the sky. I think gold has also suffered in that nominal rates have been going up. And I know that gold should follow real rates, meaning the rate after inflation. And if you go look at TIPS yields, and that's the way you can basically, TIPS yield is the yield you get after inflation. So you pick up this rate and then you look at, you know, you get inflation on top of that. TIPS yields up until 2 weeks ago had gone sideways and yet gold kept going down. So the relationship that previously very, you know, stable relationship between gold and let's say 5-year TIP yields had broken down ever since August of last year when gold had its high. And I would argue that that was, you know, something, a function of Bitcoin. And then maybe just like too many people long gold. Having said that, I think that, you know, when I'm putting on my trading hat and I'm thinking about last Thursday when the bond market had its little hissy fit, to me that looked like a kind of a washout day. It looked like something that you could be buying. I've been long steepeners and short bonds, and I actually covered a lot of those, and I bought more gold on that day, even though it seems like it seems like when everyone's accepting that rates going higher and that you get this sell-off in the bonds, the last thing you want to be doing is buying gold. But I have this maxim that trading is hard, and it's almost like the hard trade is the right trade. And
right.
To me, gold feels like it, you know, it could go up. But listen, it's been hated. I completely get it. It might be that it's still a little ways away from going up, but ultimately I think gold saves you, and it'll be interesting to see what happens if Bitcoin ever has a correction, what happens to gold.
Yeah.
And anyway, so that's gold. In terms of commodities, I also believe in commodities. I've been a huge bull on copper. I look at all this. I have this line that you should, during the gold rush, it wasn't the guys panning for gold that made all the money. It was the guys selling the picks and shovels.
Right.
And when I look at the electric vehicle rush, I have no desire to go try to buy NIO or, you know, Tesla or all these things and pay these dumb prices. I think you'd be much better off owning the things that they need. And so I think you can own any of the kind of commodities that are going in there. And I think the easiest one that makes you feel good is just kind of copper. You know, if the world goes a lot more electric, we're going to need tons and tons more copper. So I've owned copper for the longest time. I did recently pitch it, but again, that's just a trading point of view. If I'm thinking about how I'm setting up my portfolio for the long term, copper is definitely, you know, a big part of it.
Okay.
But the main one is, this is kind of when I think about how I differ from most other people. I don't believe you should own any bonds. I think bonds have traditionally been a ballast in your portfolio, kind of the risk parity model where they, you know, stocks go down, bonds go up. I think that instead of being a ballast, it's going to turn into an anchor. I think it could drag your portfolio down. And one of the things that I think that you should have a part of is actually inflation break-evens. These are a little tougher to kind of put into play, but in essence, if you go long tips and short the nominal bond, what you have is the market's expectations of inflation over the life of that bond. So you're in essence long inflation. And to me, that's a much better asset to own, because if you like, what one of the things that worries me is if we do get a bunch of inflation and rates go start going up, you know, you could have a situation where both bonds and stocks are going down.
Right.
And there's very few things that'll do well in inflation. You hope gold will, but let's face it, gold is a second derivative of inflation. It has actually more to do with the real rate than it does actually inflation. And so to get pure inflation exposure, to me, this seems like the best way.
Yeah. So what do you think about the stock market? Because when you just said that, well, the first thing that came to my mind was 72 to 74 back in the 1970s. You know, we had consumer price inflation significant, but the stock market went down by 50% in nominal terms.
Right. And then there was also that period, didn't the next 8 years, the Dow never crossed 1,000?
I don't know about the specific number.
Yeah, I think for the next, like it was a decade or something, it never crossed 1,000. It was something like that. And if you own stocks during that period, you actually got chewed up in terms of real terms. You got, you know.
And when I say stocks, just for the audience, we'll just talk about the S&P. And what do you think about that?
So, So one of my worries is I have two concerns about the S&P. Everyone tells me that indexing is going to eat every other type of investing.
Right.
And I look at it and I go, well, no, you're getting more and more concentration into these bigger and bigger stocks. I think that there's actually a lot of opportunities in smaller cap stocks. And I think that the last 6 months, or actually more like 3 months, it's really proved my case that some of these small cap stocks go so cheap and then they attracted the attention. That if you look at some of the best active managers, they were having unbelievable years. Like I talked to small cap guys and they'd be having 100+ years. Wow. It was like shooting fish in a barrel to them. So one of the things that I worry about is that going out and just buying the S&P, you are buying those seven biggest, you know, tech stocks that are at the top, right?
Right.
Amazon, Apple.
And by the way, and those growth stocks might really suffer due to higher interest rates.
Exactly. Because if you think about what a high growth stock, tech stock is, it's the longest duration asset because all of the growth is in the future. So they've benefited the most from the lowering of interest rates, and then they're the biggest portion of the actual index. So I'm hesitant to go and just say you should just buy stocks. Having said that, I do still believe that there is a potential for a 99/2000 blow off, you know, big, huge rally. You talked about M2. I have the other day I was talking to Jim Leitner, who's one of the smartest guys I've ever met. And he talked about he is a ratio. He looks at the S&P 500 versus M2. So if you look at this ratio and you go and you look at, the 1999/2000 side, you'll see that, stocks could still double from here. And he argues that the right tail, meaning buying options on a blow off top, is much cheaper. And you kind of like, I'm sympathetic to that idea. And I think it's a smart way to play it. Like if you are going to go do it, go look at 2, 3, 4 year options, you know, on the right tail. Another fellow that if you're interested, go Harley Bassman. He writes a great piece. You just Google him. He's more than happy to get everyone. He's talked about that numerous times as well. The right tail of an option in terms of how cheap it is. But the like stepping back, the other issue that I have when I'm thinking about investing in you're asking about the S&P 500 over the last, you know, decade, actually ever since the great financial crisis, the rest of the world has been hesitant to spend money. And I, you know, I've talked about Germany and Europe a lot and how, and their economy has stunk. And even though, people like if you look at the Trump, I called the most MMT president that we've ever had.
Oh, for sure.
And the reason is, if you think about him, what did he do? You know, the economy was, you know, what, 6, 7 years into an economic expansion. What did he do? He didn't go and like raise taxes and pay down the debt. He lowered taxes. And they asked him why he was doing that. He says, because there's no inflation. And, you know, you might argue that he didn't know what he was doing. You know, he does what he always does. He takes as much debt as he can. It doesn't matter. The long and short of it is that his spending and his willingness to go in and to have deficit spending made the U.S. economy, and by definition, the U.S. stock market, the best performing stock market over the last decade. And when you go look at the numbers, it hasn't even been close. The U.S. stocks have crushed it. Like it's, I think the next closest one is Japan. You know, I can't remember the numbers, but let's say the U.S. has done 12% annualized. Japan's 8%, and then the next one is like 2%. Like it's just absolutely stunning. And one of the things though that this has created is that if you were, let's say, a European pension plan manager, and you aren't overweight U.S. stocks, you got fired. Mm. Like so, the whole world to me is overweight U.S. stocks. And when I look at this and I think about it, all you would need is like just a return to benchmarks, meaning that these portfolio managers just return to their bench. They don't even need to like feel like that these other stocks are going to do better than the U.S. They just feel like it's time to return to bench.
Yeah.
And you could see a lot of U.S. stock market selling. So from a long term point of view, I would encourage people to go and start looking outside the U.S. because I think those stocks are cheaper. I think there's less concentration risk. I think that it probably helps in terms of most people are own too much of them as well for themselves.
All right.
So I love emerging markets. It's like one of those things that I close my eyes and I just own. And then the other kind of asset that I really love is Japan. Mm. I think Japan is just outstanding. You know, I mentioned that they were the second best performing asset, and you think to yourself, well, if they were the second best performing stock market, it's only because they crushed their currency, right? They did their Abenomics and they printed so much dollars. And then you look at their currency and you're like, no, it actually isn't as down as much as you would think. And, you know, it's not just me. It's people like Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett, for the first time, went out and bought 5 different kind of Japanese trading houses.
Right.
And put it in his portfolio. So I think that there's other things to own, and I think that is something that people should go have a look at.
Yeah. Okay, buddy. I sure appreciate your time. That's a fantastic conversation, as always.
My pleasure.
For my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
Sure. So go to themacrotourist.com. And if you want, just shoot me an email. It's kevin@themacrotourist.com. And I'll fire you off the last few pieces.
Awesome. Kevin, I appreciate it again. And let's do it again soon, man.
Sounds good, man. It was a lot of fun. Thanks a lot, George.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.